and welcome to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody today, who's attending to a stream of callers before she heads on the road for a weekend with family. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you my opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today being Friday, September 18, 2020, the last Friday of the summer. Sayonara, for sure. Thanks in advance to our producer and engineer, Todd. Let's get started with today's market report. In the precious metals, gold up $5 in the New York spot aftermarket. That's up about a quarter of a percent. Silver at $1,950 and change. Silver down about a quarter, just shy of 1% at $26.88. Platinum down $9. Again, about 1% at 932 ounce. And good old palladium up 35, about 1.5% at 2389. In the futures, gold up about $7 at 1957. Silver futures up about actually down eight, about 7 cents now, 2703. Other futures in domestic oil down about 4 cents today to $40.93 a barrel. International Brent crude down 27 cents at $43, reacting to some OPEC news that we'll get into shortly. The Fear and Greed Index, 52, neutral. It's been hanging there for a while, at least a week or two, but down about 16 points from 1 month ago when it was showing 68 into the greedosphere. Now, let's see, in the paper markets, in U.S. stocks, S&P down 37 and change to 33.19. Dow Jones down 244 and change at 27,657. And NASDAQ down 117 points to 10,793. Looks like the other foreign exchanges were a mixed bag. Up in China and Japan, down in Europe. And the bond market, government bond market, 10-year yield up about, 0.013 points to a yield 0.695%. The 30-year up 0.024 to 1.45%, and the 2-year up, I guess that's 0.001 of a point to 0.141. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's market report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. If I forgot to mention it, the dollar index, U.S. dollar index, was fairly flat, down ever so slightly in the 92s. So, a lot of news to report today in Melody's absence. We've got the Conference Board's leading economic index rose 1.2% in August. It's the fourth straight monthly increase, but a slower pace than the revised 2% rise in July and 3.1% gain in June. Economists had expected the indicator to increase at a pace of 1.4%. The slowing of the improvement suggests that this summer's economic rebound may be losing steam heading into the final stretch of 2020. That's according to Adaman Ozel-Yederim, who's director of business cycles research at the conference board. March saw the steepest monthly fall in the survey's history, just as the pandemic was taking hold in the U.S. Now, the leading economic indicators index is a weighted gauge of 10 indicators designed to signal business cycle trends, peaks, and valleys, and is intended to smooth out some of the volatility of individual indicators. Ozel-Yederim added that the slowing pace of improvement suggests that this summer's economic rebound may be losing steam. Now, despite the improvement, the index does remain in recession territory, still 4.7% below its pre-pandemic level in February. Looking ahead to next year, the index suggests that the U.S. economy will start the new year under substantially weakened economic conditions. And that should put the rest for now, but it won't, it should. Any talk of a pure economic recovery, much less a V-shaped one. In fact, we'll talk more about that in today's third segment. Now, looks like about 1 million homeowners have fallen through the safety net that Congress set up to protect borrowers from losing their homes. It's according to industry data, potentially leaving them vulnerable to foreclosure and eviction. Under March's CARES Act, homeowners with federally guaranteed mortgages can skip monthly payments for as long as a year without penalty and make them up later. Instead, many people have fallen behind on their payments, digging themselves into a deeper financial hole through accumulated missed payments and late fees. Overall, the number of borrowers in government mortgage bailout programs is shrinking, but those in private or bank bailouts is rising. This suggests there's still plenty of pain ahead in the mortgage market, especially as some borrowers are simply not recovering enough financially to afford their home loans, or if they're renters, their rent. The total number of mortgages in active forbearance programs, where borrowers delay their monthly payments for at least 3 months, declined by 26,000 last week. That's about 0.7%. And that marks four consecutive weeks of improvement. But again, the pace has been slowing for the past few. As of September 15th, just under 3.7 million homeowners remain in these plans, representing 7% of all active mortgages. Together, those loans represent almost $800 billion in unpaid mortgage principal. Now, the number of forbearance plans now that I just mentioned are down more than 22% from the peak of over 4.7 million in late May. The government plan, which includes borrowers with loans backed by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the FHA, and the VA, comprising the vast majority of all loans, is designed as an initial three-month plan with potential three-month extensions up to a year. Three-quarters of borrowers still in forbearance earn extensions from their initial three-month periods. Overall, there's been about a 60-40 ratio of forbearance plan extension approvals versus removal from the forbearance plan. Economist Andy Walden of Black Knight said the high number of forbearance plans set to expire in September is more akin to what we saw in June when the ratio was 80-20, and that would equate to roughly 320,000 removals. The number of borrowers in government forbearance dropped by 31,000, but those held in private labels or bank portfolios rose by 5,000. Walden added that the next few weeks will provide a lot more clarity as to what the market's going to look like heading in to the end of the year. Now, for the remainder of the first segment, we're going to talk about inflation. By the end of this, I'm sure you'll have heard all you want to about the subject, but it really is dominating the headlines in different aspects, all related to the economy. So I thought it was a good place to dig deeper on this Friday afternoon. Now, for the past decade or so, the Federal Reserve has been actually effective in helping to create inflation, not just the kind, though, that it normally targets. The Fed's perpetually easy monetary policy, consisting of historically low short-term interest rates and trillions of dollars in bond buying this year, has coincided with a huge swell in stocks in particular. What it hasn't driven is the kind of inflation the Fed likes to see. Higher wage pressures, for instance, that help improve the standard of living, as well as a signal an economy not caught in the slow growth trend that has persisted since the Great Recession. It's now hoping to change that with a new policy it wheeled out in late August and actually made official the other day. Instead of using interest rate increases to head off inflation before it hits, the Fed now will wait to hike rates until it sees inflation running persistently above its 2% target for an unspecified, even prolonged period. Now, while the move to what is being called average inflation targeting is in some respects historic for the Fed, investors still remain largely skeptical that the Fed can actually achieve its newly defined goal. Art Hogan, who's a chief market strategist at National Holdings, said inflation has been an enigma for the Fed for a decade. Is that all? And he added, clearly there are certainly risks of creating asset bubbles with easy monetary policy. There didn't seem to be much risk of actual constructive inflation. Officially, Wednesday's post-Fed meeting statement said the Fed will aim to achieve inflation moderately above 2% for some time, so that inflation averages 2% over time and longer-term inflation expectations remain well anchored at 2%. Policy, that is, interest rates, won't change, the Fed continued, quote, until these outcomes are achieved, unquote. However, inflation didn't even get past 2% when the U.S. economy was running with a 3.5% pre-pandemic unemployment rate, so said the government anyway, which at that rate would be its lowest in 50 years. So investors could be forgiven for not expecting much from an economy with an 8.5% headline unemployment rate, the decline of which historically has been an inflation sign, though that relationship has broken down since the Great Recession. Now, none of the 17 officials on the Federal Open Market Committee see inflation breaking the 2% barrier through at least 2023, at least in terms of how the government officially underestimates, calculates it. Might be one somewhat exception, which we'll talk about in a minute, from one of the Fed presidents who spoke today. And that means that current near zero short-term rate environment likely will persist for years before any change in the current structure will occur. And that poses problems on a number of levels. As Jerome Powell has spelled out repeatedly and reiterated during his news conference this week, low inflation generates low expectations, which generate the low rates that, well, Wall Street loves, consumers love, except those who save money in banks, but that the Fed fears. And Powell again stressed the limitations that these zero-ish rates put on the Fed, which loses its ability to ease policy further during times of stress, times like we're in now. When Powell was asked about the danger of asset inflation and financial instability, he actually expressed little concern about either, at the moment anyway. Still, the talk of asset inflation and a potential bubble, particularly in the stock market, against economic disinflation will continue while the Fed stays near zero and inflation is stuck well beneath the target rate. Well, again, at least according to the government. Instead, the worry may be that the Fed has little else it can do except to keep pumping up the stock market and hope the economy follows. Now, staying with the inflation theme, the U.S. is emerging as an early favorite in the all-out showdown to rekindle inflation in the world's major economies. Again, with the Fed planning to hold interest rates near zero until at least 2023, and Congress at an extended impasse over more fiscal stimulus, a pocket of the debt market is starting to see consumer prices somewhat over 2% in the coming years. And that's in stark contrast to Europe, where deflation fears have reawakened, and in Japan, which has battled declining price pressures for decades, all to no avail. It's still early, of course, and investors are still squabbling over whether the Fed will actually succeed in nudging these price gains, but they're ramping up bets that the Fed's new inflation policy and aggressive bond buying and its slate of liquidity programs will help the U.S. reflate its economy more convincingly than in other, well, developed nations. And with many central banks around the world already backed into a corner with ultra-loose monetary policy, even before this crisis began, the U.S. has quickly out-eased its peers. And that's been squelching criticism of earlier rate hikes and widening the gap between price expectations in the U.S. and the Eurozone to a decade high. Robin Brooks, who lead economist at the Institute of International Finance, says it's unambiguously a big deal that the Fed has shifted policy, and that creates headaches for the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan. Now, increased inflation certainly won't return overnight, although it's almost certainly higher than recent government numbers report. A Fed survey of economists shows that most of them see limited price pressures as far out as 10 years from now. Even the Fed itself sees inflation only hitting 2% in 2023, according to its latest median projection. There is one exception to that, St. Louis Fed President James Bullard, who today offered an optimistic look on the U.S. economy with off-the-chart growth, third-quarter growth, of 30%+ that he says will help lift inflation quicker than most people think. Let's take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CommonSenseRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody Cederstrom. We're on the web at DGScoins.com. DGScoins.com. For information and availability about our current coin special, which is 90% silver with a face value of $100 plus an MS63 St. Gaudens gold coin, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. Now, in continuing mixed news, I guess you'd call it, good news with a but, consumer sentiment increased more than expected in early September to a six-month high, as Americans surprisingly grew more upbeat about the economy's prospects, despite so many actual metrics that say it shouldn't be so. The University of Michigan's preliminary sentiment index for September advanced to 78.9 from a final August reading of 74.1. The median estimate for economists was just 75. So the measure of expectations rose 4.8 points, also a six-month high, while a gauge of current conditions increased 4.8 6 points. That's to 87.5. Just 16% of respondents said they expected the economy to worsen in the year ahead. And that's the smallest share since 2015 and consistent with an economy and labor market that are slowly recovering. Age of sentiment, however, still remains below its pre-pandemic levels, and Americans were less upbeat about prospects for their own finances. Consumers were more hopeful about buying conditions for durable goods. Director of the survey, Richard Curtin, said over the next several months, there are two factors that could cause volatile shifts over steep losses in consumer confidence: how the elections decided and delays in obtaining vaccinations. The Michigan report also showed inflation expectations declining slightly in September. Consumers anticipated inflation rising 2.7% in the year ahead. Boy, that make the Fed happy. Down from 3.1% in August, while longer-term inflation expectations also fell. So some interesting opinions. Once again, they're sentiments versus actual production or outcome numbers. And speaking of output and production, Saudi Arabia showed its determination to protect the oil recovery, warning short sellers not to challenge its resolve and delivering a rare public rebuke to a close ally that's been overproducing. After a meeting with fellow OPEC Plus ministers yesterday, Saudi Energy Minister Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman dropped clear hints that there could be a change of direction in production policy before the group's next meeting, which is in December. As the rebound in oil prices falters, the prince invoked his hero. Listen to this: former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan, of all people, with an attempt to bend global markets to his will. Bin Salman said, "We will never leave this market unattended. I want the guys in the trading floors to be as jumpy as possible. I'm going to make sure whoever gambles on this market will be ouching like hell." Go ahead, Prince. Uh, Well, international Brent crude did dip below $40 a barrel last week for the first time since early summer. There are growing signs that the pandemic continues to hurt oil demand as people and businesses around the world face tightening restrictions on their activities, or those who just choose not to do the traveling they used to. So it will be interesting. I mean, the prince didn't name any specific offenders, although sitting in silence alongside of him was UAE Energy Minister, who made a rare post-pandemic trip from Abu Dhabi to Riyadh to atone for exceeding his output target. The UAE has become one of the worst quota breakers in OPEC Plus, making just 10% of its pledge cuts in August. Naughty, naughty, UAE. They're feeling their oats since they now have an open door with Israel. Back here in the States, the IRS has a message for about 9 million Americans. You could still be eligible for that $1,200 stimulus check. The government has already sent out about 160 million stimulus checks since the CARES Act authorized those payments in late March. Still, millions of Americans have yet to receive any money for one key reason. They typically don't file federal tax returns, usually because their income's too low, and so consequently they don't have current information on file with the IRS. Now, those Americans, and they'll be advised this, have until October 15th to use the tax agency's non-filer tool to register to receive their payments this year. Those who can't access the online tool can file a simplified paper return instead. The IRS is mailing about 9 million letters to Americans to notify them of the deadline as part of its last push for a public awareness campaign that began 6 months ago. Now, receiving a letter doesn't guarantee that an individual or family is actually eligible for the money. They still have to meet certain qualifications, like having a valid Social Security number, being a U.S. citizen, or having resident alien status, and not having been claimed as someone else's dependent on a federal tax return. Now, more information on eligibility requirements can be found in the IRS website at irs.gov. irs.gov. Some other decent news for some. Your health insurance company may actually owe you some money. And I doubt many people know about this. Depending on how you get your coverage, your health coverage, you'd be one of roughly 8 million policyholders who are expected to get a piece of about $2.7 billion in premium rebates from various insurers around the country. While such refunds are issued annually, the anticipated amount would be nearly double the $1.4 billion issued just last year. Generally, you're more likely to get this rebate or already have received one in recent weeks if you have an individual policy, either through the federal or one of the state exchanges, or if you participate in a small or large group plan. Now, many of the biggest U.S. employers choose to self-insure, which means their plans don't have to adhere to certain requirements placed on insurance companies. Different rules also apply to Medicare and Medicaid coverage. But the average rebate last year was $208, although that figure varied widely from state to state. In Kansas, for example, each eligible person got an average of almost $1,400, while in Delaware, it was zero. So you may ask, why are these rebates even going out? Well, basically, insurance companies that sell group or individual policies have to adhere to what's called a medical loss ratio. That requires the insurer to spend no more than 20% of premiums paid by enrollees on administration, marketing, salaries, and the like. The remaining 80% must be spent on healthcare costs and certain other expenses related to patient health. Sometimes that ratio is 85-15. But in any event, the ratio is calculated based on a rolling three-year average each year. So the rebates this year, 2020, are based on data from 2017, 18, and 19. Insurers typically either send a check to policyholders or deduct the rebate from premiums and send a check to individuals who are no longer enrolled, but are who are due a piece of the pie. There's also something else at play. Insurance companies aren't having a bad year profit-wise. While they've paid out for claims related to the treatment of COVID-19, they've paid far less on projected claims related to elective medical procedures, which, as you might recall, was shut down for 3 or 4 months at the onset of the pandemic. This means that their ratio may be way out of whack for 2020, which would potentially cause even bigger rebates next year when that rolling average rolls forward. Or insurers can take action this year to bring that ratio into line. For example, if they reduce their premium now, the ratio will look better, thus forcing smaller rebates. So be on the lookout for that. If you're not aware of the program and you get a check from your insurance company or a credit, say on your toward your December premium, well, now you know why. On the tax front, I guess it could be a harbinger of things to come, especially if the pandemic continues for a longer period of time and Congress and the White House don't agree on a bailout plan for state and local governments. But New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy announced a deal yesterday. I don't know if you saw this with his state lawmakers to hike taxes on New Jersey's wealthiest residents as part of a plan to provide relief to Jersey's middle class taxpayers from the financial crisis. If the agreement actually becomes law, it would be one of the first in the country to address state revenue shortfalls caused by the pandemic by upping collections on the rich. Murphy said, in fact, he hopes to have the tax finalized for votes next month. States across the country have been hard hit by the pandemic, which has forced tens of thousands of businesses to close, far too many of them permanently. And that sent state sales tax revenues plummeting. Calls for federal assistance to states by congressional Democrats have stalled, with President Trump and other Republicans in the Senate primarily blaming governors and other local leaders for their budget problems. Even some Democrats have been wary of raising taxes on the rich to fill these gaps. In neighboring New York, for example, Governor Andrew Cuomo has rejected similar calls, fearing they would cause the wealthy to flee to other states. In fact, they already have, particularly from New York to, say, Florida and other southern states. Murphy, in contrast, said at a press conference announcing the plan that he was simply calling for pennies on their top dollars earned that would help undo years of tax inequities. The deal would raise the tax rate on those earning more than $1 million per year to 10.75% from 8.97%, and provide a rebate of up to $500 to households earning less than $150,000 if they have at least one child. The income cap for a single-parent household would be $75,000. Under current New Jersey law, the 10.75 rate applies only to those earning more than $5 million. That, again, would go down to those earning more than $1 million. The rebate checks would go out by next summer and are expected to benefit as many of 800,000 New Jersey families. Murphy's administration has estimated that the tax increase could bring in close to $400 million in revenue per year. State Senate President Steve Sweeney, an Assembly Speaker, Craig Coughlin, Democrats who had resisted this so-called millionaires tax, said they had come on board with the plan. Sweeney emphasized that the new tax was not driven by animosity towards the well-off. In fact, he said, "We do not hold any grudge at all against those who have been successful in life." State Republicans blasted the plan. Well, you know the old adage, you can pay me now or pay me later. Well, companies that took advantage of federal pandemic relief efforts like payroll tax deferrals this year are going to face bigger bills next year, possibly for 2 years, complicating an already challenging climb out of the financial crisis for thousands and thousands of companies. In recent 10Q filings and investor calls, public companies have started to outline some of the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of immediate cash benefits they reaped from this payroll tax holiday. And that's even as they warn of the headwinds it may create when those bills actually come true. One tax attorney said, "While this may be good for short-term cash flow, it may backfire." So instead of making prudent cost cuts, employers are now under an even more serious financial crisis with new obligations to the U.S. Treasury. But while companies hit the pause on payouts, the meter is still running. Unpaid payroll taxes will total an estimated $211 billion this year. That's according to Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. The relief package allows companies to defer their portion of FICA taxes for Social Security and Medicare. Employers pay 6.2% of an employee's check to Social Security and 1.45% to Medicare. The stimulus law requires businesses to pay half of this back next year and the remainder in 2022. Now, separately, it's important to note, the president tried to implement an executive order that would allow companies to defer the portion of Social Security taxes that workers pay, the employee share, until the end of the year. But the measure, seen by a lot of people as tied more to re-election efforts than any real economic benefits, is largely fizzled because it would leave companies ultimately responsible for unpaid taxes. Gosh, that came so quick. We're up against a break. Some important messages coming your way. We'll be back in just a few short minutes. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Financial Survival. I'm your host, Dave Allen. Now, our latest blog, which is out as we speak, is about recent White House claims that we're in the midst of a broad-based V-shaped recovery. Listeners can subscribe to our free weekly blogs and newsletters at dgscoins.com, or you can read them on our Facebook page, which is the @DGSCoins. But before I get into that blog. Let me just talk about a couple of other things first. The Democratic Republic of Congo, interestingly, is emerging as the country with the world's largest food crisis. Almost 22 million people in that nation are acutely food insecure. That's according to new figures from the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. The staggering figure, 22 million, underscores how the fallout from the pandemic is driving up hunger, particularly in countries that were already gripped by crisis. Now, in addition to the Congo, the worst destinations in acute hunger in recent months have been in Burkina Faso, which has seen a 300% uptick in the number of people experiencing acute hunger since the beginning of the year, as well as Nigeria, Somalia, and the Sudan. Not surprisingly, most of those countries, to a certain extent, have been facing ongoing sectarian violence. In Nigeria, working the land can be a dangerous occupation because of the long-standing religious and ethnic tensions, as well as more recently organized crime. And that comes as farmers already were having to contend with the flooding and drought. It's all now hitting agriculture just when the country needs it most. The pandemic has triggered a surge in food prices there in a nation that imports more than a tenth of its food supply, which isn't good in a good situation. With 200 million people, Nigeria is the most populous country in the world's most food insecure continent. That's a lot of people, ladies and gentlemen, for such a small, relatively speaking, land size. Producing food at home matters more as importers struggle to access dollars to pay for shipments from overseas after an oil price crash sapped foreign currency reserves. Niger's state governor, Abubakar Sanibello, warned way back in April, we're heading toward famine and starvation. Now, these challenges come as the world's forecast for a sharp rise in food insecurity because of COVID-19 and its impact. As many as 132 million more people around the world may fall into the grip of hunger this year, including many places that used to have, relative stability. And perhaps that's why more and more Wall Street bigwigs have been calling on their fellow billionaires to donate more of their booming assets to help solve this growing crisis. I don't know about you, ladies and gentlemen. It sounds reasonable to me. Now, let's talk a little bit about infrastructure for a minute. The next phase, the economic rebound, is likely, if not to be driven, then certainly to include more infrastructure investment. And some are saying particularly commodity-intensive infrastructure investment, potentially setting the stage for further gains across that industrial space in the coming months and few years. Now, the prediction comes at a time when market participants are really closely monitoring the strength of economies around the world, as many countries are coming to terms with an upsurge in the number of reported infections. The pandemic has prompted forecasters to issue dire economic projections this year, and the OECD just warned the other day that the outlook remains exceptionally uncertain. I like that term, exceptionally uncertain. One sign the rebound may be gaining some momentum, however, came as the world's second largest economy reported industrial output expanding the most in 8 months last month. China, which has been in rebound mode for several months now, published data on Tuesday showing industrial output growth accelerated to 5.6% in August when compared to a year ago. That bolsters the view that Beijing's demand recovery is gathering pace, with government stimulus helping to fuel a rebound. Max Layton, head of commodities research at Citi, said it's been absolutely stunning how strong China has rebounded on the construction side of things, reflecting on the spectacular rally seen across the industrial commodity space as a result. Hey, it's good to be king! Or in this case, czar. Layton identified three big catalysts for commodity investors to track through to the end of the year: vaccine news, the strength of China's economic recovery, and the scale of continuing U.S. easing. We'll say, one guy said, hey, why waste a good crisis? You can actually get through a lot of the infrastructure programs you've been waiting decades to actually get through the door this time. I guess we'll see what comes in that respect. In the meantime, the grounding of Boeing 737 MAX was the worst crisis in the plane maker's century-long history, at least until the global pandemic hit. Now, investors expect it to be cleared to fly again before the end of the year, but orders for what was once the company's biggest moneymaker were expected to rebound after the ungrounding, but ain't gonna happen. Especially after Congress released a 200-plus page report this week outlining the horrific culmination of events that caused the crashes, laying blame on Boeing and its key regulator, the FAA. Order cancellations are piling up. Scrapped orders have consistently outpaced new orders. Boeing will likely survive this downturn, ladies and gentlemen, but it's going to be a tough ride, especially with air travel still down 90%. Now, back to that blog. President Trump claimed a week ago that a V-shaped recovery is underway. And his chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, scary thing indeed, followed up with a claim of similar dubious nature that the recovery was very, very broad-based. Hold on there, fellas. I'm not even sure we can concur with the assertion we're in the midst of any kind of recovery, much less one that's V-shaped. A rebound? Okay. Temporary as it may be. I mean, but Econ 101 teaches us that a traditional economic recovery is the business cycle stage following a recession that's characterized by a lasting period of improving business activity. Well, look, for one thing, we're still in the midst of a recession, not in the aftermath of one. For another, even if we were out of the recession, we haven't had nearly enough time of improving business activity to consider it lasting. So again, I suggest rebound, perhaps. Recovery, certainly not V-shaped. It looks like Trump's and Kudlow's victory lap last Friday in the White House briefing room was a tad premature at best. Bush's 43 mission accomplished, not, comes to mind. At worst, well, there's a historic election 46 days from now. Now, last week's deja vu moment followed reports that the economy added almost 1.4 million jobs in August, with the government's headline unemployment rate falling to 8.4%. But Trump and Kudlow's declarations of a V-shaped recovery with very, very broad-based gains were as far off the mark as Dick Cheney's target practice. True, the economy's coming back from its steep cliff dive in the spring, but it's not pretty amazing as was maintained. In fact, it's a lot slower and much more limited than its second quarter collapse was. For starters, the job growth that administration officials were spouting off about was just a small fraction of the jobs that had been lost during the pandemic. Remember that in April alone, nearly 21 million Americans lost their jobs. In the 4 months since then, less than half of those lost jobs have been refilled. Of even more concern, the pace of new job additions has slowed markedly since June. That's when the economy added back 4.8 million jobs. In fact, if you exclude the 238,000 temporary census workers from August numbers, only slightly over 1.1 million Americans were rehired. Now, that's still 1.1 million more Americans that were unemployed the month before. So that's not a bad thing, just in the aggregate. The claims versus reality are dubious. And when the Labor Department's headline U3 unemployment number of 8.4% is adjusted for what the Bureau calls reclassification errors, the actual jobless rate is still above 9%, which is a joke and badly kept secret anyway. A more realistic number, unemployment number, is the U6 rate, the Bureau of Labor Statistics' broadest unemployment measure, which includes short-term discouraged and other marginally attached workers, as well as those forced to work part-time because they can't find full-time employment. That rate in August was a little shy of 15%. Am I getting your attention? ShadowStats.com's John Williams believed the actual job rate in August was 28%. Williams' rate reflects, he calls it the alternative rate, reflects current unemployment reporting methods adjusted for estimated long-term discouraged workers who were defined out of official existence as far back as 1994. And then that estimate's added to the BLS estimate of U6 unemployment to come up with the 28%. Now, even if you discount or outrightly dismiss Williams' somewhat cumbersome methods for calculating that actual or alternative rate of 28%, a U6 rate of 15% is still astronomically higher than the government's basic reported rate of 8.4%. And that's the number that mainstream media should be talking about all the time. And just as job losses related to the pandemic have been disproportionately concentrated among certain demographic groups, well, so too have the jobs added back, contrary to Kudlow's claim of their being very, very broad-based. And that's because pandemic job losses have been concentrated in a few industries, like travel, restaurants, bars, and recreation. All told, though, relative to overall U3 jobless rate of 8.4%, over 11% of Black Americans have lost their jobs compared to 6.4% of whites. Almost 19% of those with less than a high school diploma have become unemployed, while employment among those with a college degree is almost fully returned to pre-pandemic levels. And roughly 8% fewer women are employed compared to before the crisis, while employment among men is down 6.7%. As for what the future holds, let's just say it's not so bright you gotta wear shades. Close to 1 million Americans have been losing their jobs every week, and recently more than a half dozen major American companies have announced plans for significant layoffs and buyouts. None of those job reductions are reflected in the August report. No future ones will be in the future job reports. In particular, the airlines, which agreed to postpone any layoffs as part of receiving close to $25 billion and government pandemic aid have announced massive workforce reductions that will take effect starting in 2 weeks. American Airlines with 19,000 coming furloughs, and United Airlines with over 16,000 lead the pack in that struggling industry. Another hard-hit company, MGM Resorts, has sent pink slips to 18,000 workers, more than 25% of its pre-pandemic workforce. Even companies that were less in the eye of the storm, like Salesforce.com with 1,000 employee reduction, and Coca-Cola with 4,000, have announced cutbacks. Meanwhile, have I mentioned that Congress and the White House remain at odds over another stimulus package? Well, contrary to the mantra, we're all in this together, with each passing week, it seems more like, sorry, you're on your own. Again, be on the lookout in your email inboxes for our blog. And if you're not a current subscriber, please go to dgscoins.com, look for the mailbox, and sign up. Be glad to have you. Well, look, it's about that time. What a week it's been. It's all the time we have for today's program. Melody will be back on Monday. I'll be there with her. My name is Dave Allen. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend, and be safe out there. Bye-bye.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.